Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how they affect our nation's future. This week, we'll look at immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She has extensive experience with the U.S. immigration system, serving in senior positions at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and the Department of Homeland Security. And last week, Teresa and I participated in a panel discussion on the economics of immigration, hosted by the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. And in case you couldn't be there, I thought it would be a good idea to invite Teresa onto the show this week to share her perspectives. She's been on the show before as a guest. So Teresa, welcome back to Facing the Future.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Great to be here.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to talk about under the broad topic of immigration and immigration reform. So let's begin where we did at the Rudman Center on our discussion, just by getting your overview of the system. What are the key parts? And then we'll go and dissect what's wrong with everything. But really, what are we talking about here for the overall system?
Well, I really appreciate this because I think a lot of people really don't understand the way our immigration system works today. And it's very, very different from the way maybe your grandparents arrived to the country or your great-grandparents. It's very different from the Ellis Island model. So let's start with our legal immigration system, how people can come and settle permanently in the United States and get what we call green cards. There are really five different ways that somebody can get a green card. The first is based on a family relationship to a U.S. citizen or an existing green card holder. And if you are an immediate family member, or in some cases, a brother or sister, adult children, you can have your U.S. citizen or green card holder's relative sponsor you for a green card. And that represents about 60% of the green cards that we issue each year. Some of those categories, such as immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, which are the spouse, minor children, and parents of U.S. citizens, can come into the United States without any annual limits, what we call green card caps. They're exempt from those caps. But other categories of relatives, particularly the relatives of green card holders, have an annual cap that is usually somewhere around $226,000 a year. The second category is employment-based immigration. That's about 140,000 green cards a year. And that's based on if you have an employer in the United States who is willing to sponsor you to work in a particular job for them in the United States. Or you can sponsor yourself if you're of an extraordinary ability in the arts, sciences, business, or athletics. And oftentimes those are, you know, we think of the Nobel Prize winners or the Oscar winners. There's also a category for people who invest in the United States in investments that can create U.S. jobs. That requires at least $800,000 to $1.5 million of investment in the United States. Another category is what we call the diversity lottery. This is actually a real lottery that the State Department runs. 50,000 green cards a year are given out by lottery, but you have to be from a country that has seen lower levels of immigration over the last several years to the United States. And what that means is in each of the last several years, more than, you know, several million applicants for those 50,000 visas apply every year. So it's really hard to get. And then there's humanitarian visas. So if you qualify as a refugee or an asylee to the United States, if you've been granted that status, after a year, you can apply to get a green card. And then there's what we call, I call the odds and ends other categories. So every once in a while, Congress will pass a law granting green cards to a particular group of people outside of that regular system. Usually it's a few thousand here and there. For example, the people who helped the United States military in Iraq and Afghanistan could be eligible for green cards, something called a special immigrant visa, or a legalization program for Liberians who had been longtime residents in the United States passed Congress a couple of years ago, and that helped a few thousand people. So those are the major green card categories. And then we have temporary visas, and there are dozens and dozens of temporary visas for everything from your standard tourist and business visitor to employees of international organizations in the United States, like the World Bank, to people who are working in specialty occupations, the H-1B visa or agriculture, the H-2A visa. There's a visa for religious workers. There's a visa for people who work for international media outlets. These visas are allow somebody to come for a specific period of time to do a specific thing. It doesn't necessarily lead to a green card. As a matter of fact, most categories require you to prove that you don't intend to permanently immigrate before you can get one of these temporary visas. So that's the main part of our immigration system. And I think the main thing I would want your listeners to understand is this system has been in place since 1965, and it was last updated in 1990. So our laws have not been changed, and these categories and the numbers have not really been updated in more than 30 years. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people say that our current immigration system isn't working, because it was created in a different time with maybe different priorities, and a lot of people would like to see changes.
Is there a theory of the case on our immigration system? In other words, is it mainly about family reunification? Is it mainly about economic growth, humanitarian needs, or is it kind of a hodgepodge that was thrown together haphazardly?
Well, I wish I could say that there was purpose behind it, but the reality is it is kind of a hodgepodge. You know, our immigration system, when it was first created in the 1950s, the modern immigration system, was to create some particular categories of visa. Because prior to that, we said these are people who can't come in. We had quotas and restrictions, but we didn't have categories that described who was able to come in. And so basically, if you arrived and you weren't covered under one of these exclusion grounds, you were able to come in and stay. And these exclusions were, though, had limits based on the country you were from, and these limits varied. So, you know, a law passed in 1924 limited immigration to the same levels of from countries who had had immigrants settle 30 years prior to 1924. So the primary purpose of that law was to kind of keep the, if you will, the ethnic and racial makeup of the United States looking the same. In 1965, during the heights of the civil rights movement, they finally got rid of that differential quota system and said, well, we'll make it equal. Every country in the world will have the same number of visas. And that's when they first created these categories, the family-based, employment-based categories, and others. And from that point on, what you see is that you really do have to have somebody in the United States in the most cases sponsor you. You can't, it's very, very few categories and very few immigrants around the world would be able to come on their own and immigrate to the United States. And that was a big turnaround from before. The other thing is, as we said, the numbers favor family-based migration. And, you know, a lot of people now look back and then say, oh, well, it reflects our family values and family reunification is very important. And I agree, it is. But if you go back and look at the congressional record when they were debating that law, the members of Congress who were supporting primarily family-based immigration said, well, if only existing immigrants and U.S. citizens are sponsoring people to come, then the new people coming will look like the people already here. So even though we now say, oh, look at this wonderful thing of family values, it really was still about not changing the ethnic and racial makeup of the United States. Of course, it didn't work out that way, as we know now. And we see, you know, a much, much more diverse group of people coming to the United States than were coming in the 1950s and 1960s. The numbers are not really based on any economic evidence. The numbers that we allow in are based on basically congressional negotiations. Member of Congress get in the room and say, well, we had this many last year. I think I could probably vote for this many now. There's no rationale for it. Even our economic-based migration stream, even though it represents less than 20% of the visas, is geared towards skilled immigration mostly, but we have a lot of needs that are not skilled immigration to the United States, and we don't really have very many ways for unskilled immigrants to come and work. And one of the arguments we have about dealing with the border, and many people will advocate, is that if we had more ability for these workers to come on a legal visa to work, which is one reason why many of them would be coming, they wouldn't be coming illegally to the United States. But we have not updated that system in a long time. So I do think that there is definitely room in our system to rethink this. I often say, if you ask me if there is a mission statement for our immigration system, I'm not sure I could answer you.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. And I'm discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. I'm discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. In our first segment, we talked about the immigration system overall. Teresa, I think anybody that thinks about immigration right now, it's all about the border. This is, you know, we don't really think about the overall immigration system. It's about what's happening right now on the border. And why is that?
You know, I think it is true, for better or for worse. Most Americans, if they don't have personal experience with the immigration system or someone they know, all they ever see or hear about immigration is pictures of what's happening at the border, and particularly when the border is not under control, if you will, or it seems like it's out of control. And that's certainly what we have seen over the last decade, is increasingly news reports and pictures of a border that just seems like it's out of control. I think there's many reasons for that. And one of them is that for most of our history that we have enforced immigration law at the U.S.-Mexico border, and let's be clear, the Border Patrol was founded in 1924. So before that, we didn't enforce immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border at all. It was pretty much open for people to cross. But once the Border Patrol was created, and once we really started enforcing our immigration laws, from that time until about 10 years ago, 80 to 90% of everybody we ever encountered trying to cross that border was Mexican. And that matters because our infrastructure, our process, and our ability to manage that migration when people tried to illegally cross was benefited by the fact that as a Mexican person, we could send them immediately back across the border to Mexico. As a matter of fact, for the most of our century, that's exactly what we did. We didn't hold people in custody for very long at all. And so our Border Patrol facilities, for example, were built like your local police precinct. It had various cells that were meant to hold people for a couple of days at most before we could send them back to Mexico. But what started happening about a decade ago is we started seeing more and more people who weren't Mexicans coming to the border, mainly from Central America, from the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And increasingly, unlike previous decades, these were not adult men who were coming to look for work and trying to sneak by Border Patrol. We had unaccompanied children and families who were turning themselves in and asking for asylum. Now, this is important because even though someone enters the country illegally, our law is very clear that you are allowed to ask for asylum as soon as you're on U.S. territory, no matter how you enter. As a matter of fact, if you successfully get asylum, that prevents your deportation. So it's considered a defensive asylum claim. So once you have turned yourself in and said, I'd like to ask for asylum, then the United States is obligated under our law to give you a hearing on that asylum claim. But once we started seeing non-Mexican people, and that's important because we can't send non-Mexican people back to Mexico unless Mexico is willing to take them, and they don't have to. That's a negotiation. That becomes foreign policy, right? And if they've asked for asylum, we now have to put them through that process. So the more people that arrive that we couldn't send right back to Mexico because Mexico wouldn't take them, and we had to now apply this asylum process to, it started to overwhelm our facilities who weren't meant to hold people for very long, particularly families and children. It started overwhelming our asylum process at the border. We didn't have enough asylum officers to interview people. Cases were sent to immigration court and they started becoming overwhelmed. And so what has happened in the years since now, it's not just Central Americans, it's South Americans, Venezuelans, Caribbean nationals, actually people from all over the world. Last year, there was more than 100 different countries represented in the number of people we encountered at the border. And that has just meant that the system and processes that we had put in place to deal with what was mostly a Mexican problem are no longer working. And without a change in the law, anybody who arrives and asks for asylum, we still have to manage that process. So that's really where we're at. And you've seen different presidents from Obama to Trump to Biden try to address this without Congress changing the law. And frankly, every one of them, no matter what they have tried to do, has ended up with those policies in court. And that creates another challenge at the border. And so these policies get bounced back and forth. They get on and off and on and off. And now that creates just more uncertainty and chaos. And that benefits the smugglers who are encouraging the migrants to come. And I think that's one of the big challenges. And to go back to something I said in the first segment, you know, a lot of these people, even though they firmly believe that they are deserving of protection, may not meet the legal requirements of asylum. They may believe that they will suffer harm or their families will suffer harm, but it's a high bar legally to prove that. At the same time, many of them would benefit from being able to come and work in the United States, and our legal immigration system doesn't allow most of them to try to do that. I mentioned we have limits on the number of green cards that are available for employment-based immigration, and you have to already have a sponsor. And also, it depends on what country you come from. You might have to wait several years before you could get that green card. We don't have a temporary work visa for a job that is year-round, that doesn't require a bachelor's degree. So there's no temporary visa you can come in on. So these limitations may be one reason why we're seeing more people just desperately trying any way they can to come to the United States.
You know, that what you've just described is my impression going back from when I was in law school and took a course in immigration law, or worked at briefly at the Board of Immigration Appeals as a paralegal. The idea of asylum was kind of an emergency thing. I mean, it was the stray person that would cross the border, you know, with a step ahead of somebody that was trying to kill them or whatever, you know. Yeah. And it wasn't this, you know, tens of thousands a month coming. And so, like you said, the system is radically out of tune with the situation that we actually have. So is it a matter of trying to change the law of what asylum is, or just throwing in the towel on that and devoting the resources to deal with the different view of asylum, you know, as it has evolved on the ground? Yeah. So far, we're not doing either.
We're not doing either. You know, it's interesting because I think if we had decided to really beef up our asylum officer corps, our immigration courts, say, even 8 years ago, we might have been able to keep ahead of these backlogs. But let me tell you where we are right now. 3 million cases in U.S. immigration court. The average asylum case that started today would take anywhere from 5 to 8 years to complete. That's how many cases we have in immigration court and how backlogged they are. Even asylum officers, you know, the affirmative asylum case. So if you're admitted legally to the United States or paroled in, you have a year under which you can file for asylum with U.S. citizenship and immigration services rather than the immigration court. And that's backlogged by some 400 to 500,000 cases. So everything is bogged down. We are so far behind now that we would probably have to triple the number of adjudicators in both the affirmative and immigration courts to even try to keep up with the incoming cases. And that's really hard to do because it's really hard to hire federal government positions if you haven't tried. It takes a long time. And so the resources are, you know, keeping ahead of the numbers of arrivals just to keep from growing those backlogs would be a Herculean effort. So I do think we need to think about how we process asylum cases at the border. The standard for asylum was crafted back in the 1960s. It's based on the idea of persecution, usually by a government entity or where a government entity is not preventing persecution from happening. But it has to be on account of very strict criteria, on account of your race or your religion or your political opinion or your nationality or your membership in some particular social group. So that's a very legalistic definition, but it was based back in the days when most asylum seekers were people who were literally fleeing their governments. Now we see people who are fleeing criminal gangs in their country that they're not able, that the government is not able to protect them from, or are suffering from poverty that their government can't alleviate. There are many who probably do have legitimate asylum claims, but they're mixed in a lot of other people who have maybe not the strongest claims for asylum under our current laws. That having been said, I think if we were to change the criteria for asylum, you know, that would be very difficult to do. We are subject to some international treaties on that. But we could change the way we process asylum seekers at the border and create a more expeditious process. Right now, asylum seekers at the border, as you said, when they used to be few and far between, could go into our regular asylum systems, our regular immigration court systems, and probably get a hearing within a year. That's no longer the case. So we probably need to create a separate system that's just for these border cases that can decide much more quickly whether or not somebody has a real ability to claim asylum. But then we need the resources to do that.
And we'll talk some more about that. We'll get into the economics of immigration on the other side of the break. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and we're discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I'm discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Teresa, you know, we've been talking about the border and we're talking about the overall immigration system. I want to turn the focus now to the economics. You know, the economic and budgetary effects of immigration, which is why the Concord Coalition keeps coming back to this, because it does have an effect. And it's, frankly, I don't think of it really as, I don't think of the budgetary effects first of this. There are budgetary effects, but I think of it more on the economic growth side. You know, when but the Concord Coalition worries ultimately about the debt to GDP ratio. And so this is not so much about the debt, it's about the GDP. If you can expand the GDP, you can afford more debt. Not that I advocate it, I'm just saying both sides of the equation can help. And we have a real problem with projected economic growth in this country that I think a lot of people don't realize, and that is the slowdown in population growth and the and consequential slowdown in the workforce. Now, if you have a growing economy depends on a growing workforce and a more productive workforce. So two big factors, workforce growth and productivity. Immigration can actually help with both, but more measurably on the workforce growth. And you know, we really need it because fertility rates have dropped in this country. We used to have high fertility rates in this country, better than Europe and many other countries. And that, along with immigration, helped us have a booming economy. We now have a different prospect on fertility rates. They've gone below replacement rates like they have in many other countries. which is about 2.1%. They're now down around 1.7. And that means that the projected workforce growth is projected to slow considerably over the next few decades, rather dramatically. And that is why CBO and the Fed and lots of other people project a much slower real GDP growth, because we're not going to have enough workers. And so you look to immigration as, you know, is there an economic strategy for the United States to increase immigration to help with the workforce growth problem that we have? And I, you know, one of my favorite statistics here is that the Congressional Budget Office projects that by 2040, not so long ago, we're going to have, well, not so long in the future, we're going to have more deaths in this country than births. Mm-hmm. And immigration is going to be the only reason that the population will grow, or that the workforce will grow. I look at the debates now about immigration and attempts to even restrict immigration, and I think, you know, this is committing economic suicide. I mean, we have to be careful about the border. We do. I'm a lawyer. I want to enforce the laws. But on the other hand, our mindset should be, how do we bring in the people we want and need for a growing economy, and not how do we keep people out?
One thing that you mentioned, you know, you mentioned sort of the declining fertility rates and the CBO projection, but another big part of this is that our largest generation is the baby boomers, and they are retiring now. We are at what BPC's chief economist Jason Fichtner called peak 65. So more people, every year, more and more people are reaching 65 and retiring out of the workforce. But what that means is that we have fewer and fewer workers to support the aging, retiring population. And with declining fertility rates, we're not replacing them in the workforce. So if you look at the workforce, and we've had also had declining labor force participation rates by certain groups of people, particularly since COVID, that hasn't rebounded. And some of that is because more and more people are retiring. They're not participating in the labor force. So not only does immigration grow the overall population, most immigrants arrive at working age. So they start working immediately, whereas if we were to increase our fertility rates, it would take at least 16 to 18 years before they enter the workforce, let's be real, and or longer. And so that's not an instantaneous boost there. But immigration is. And so, you know, from an economic perspective, when we look at just those population and workforce issues, immigration is really where the most obvious way that we can try to forestall some of the economic consequences of what we know our demographic predictions are going to look like.
Sticking with this theme of the economics of this, we had sort of an unintended experiment in the last year or two in bringing in many, many, many new workers. You know, we usually have around 900,000. You think about that as normal, 900,000 net immigration. 2022 was about 2.6 million, and CBO says 2023 was about 3.3 million. And CBO, in their latest economic and budget update, in their long-term outlook, said, you know, we think that increased immigration is responsible, partially anyway, for the fact that we didn't have a recession in the last year. Everybody was expecting one. CBO said that immigration boost really added about $7 trillion to their GDP forecast over the next 10 years and about $1 trillion in revenue. So it wasn't intended. Nobody said, hey, let's see what happens if we, you know, triple immigration. But the economic positive, the beneficial positive economic effects were shown in the numbers. We didn't do it intentionally, but yeah. This is kind of, I take it to be an interesting experiment.
Well, it's interesting because CBO is sort of the first government agency or any economic agency to really look at the number of arrivals we've seen at the border over the last several years and look at it from an economic standpoint. Obviously, we've already talked about how it's a structural problem for our border and for managing things. But what they did that, say, Census Bureau hasn't done or Social Security trustees didn't do when they started looking at workforce and population projections is CBO went to Department of Homeland Security and said, tell us about how many people have been admitted to the country and on what status. So they're the first government agency that included what they call this other worker category. So they were looking not just at legal immigration, which, as you mentioned, has been around net about 900,000 a year average before COVID. COVID dropped it substantially. Yeah. But we rebounded our legal immigration and added this these numbers from the border. And they said that, you know, they're estimating because of this bump, there will be 5.2 million more people in 2033 than they had projected last year in 2023, an increase of about 2.7% in the labor force, which is important. And most of this is coming from this other category. And so if you look at the people who have been arriving at the border, the ones who have been processed to wait an immigration case in immigration court, they're, I would say, quasi-legally here, right? The government has processed them. They're in a process to determine if they get to stay, but they may not get legal work authorization for months or years down the line if they do. And some others have been paroled in, so they might get more immediate work authorization. There's a lot of different statuses. My colleagues over at the Migration Policy Institute call them liminal status, because it's not a formal green card. It's not even a temporary visa with specific terms and conditions. It is this amorphous sort of limbo state where you're waiting on some other government agency to decide. So one of the things we don't know is whether or how many of these people will ultimately remain in the United States. And that's one reason why CBO didn't predict that this number would continue. They said after a couple of years, we're just going to revert to the mean because geez, we don't know what's going to happen, right? Which is, you know, I guess that's about as good as you can guess. If we wanted our immigration system to really have this economic impact, we'd want these people to have a more permanent status, right? We'd want them to have a green card or some other status that enables them to be fully embedded in the economic market in the United States, working at their full potential, definitely working above board. And one of the things CBO said is, we're estimating that almost all of these people are going to work within 6 months, whether they have authorization or not, right?
Yeah.
So they're saying, look, people aren't going to sit around on their hands. They can't collect benefits. They're going to find a way to work, whether that's legally or not. So it's important to recognize that everybody who participates in the labor market is supporting our economic growth. But from an immigration policy perspective, it will be far better if they were here on a permanent legal status.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I'm discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. And this week, I'm discussing immigration reform with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And Teresa, we've been talking about the economic benefits of immigration and the system as a whole, but not everybody is a big fan of increasing immigration. And people raise all sorts of potential arguments, whether it would be harmful to, native-born workers. Does it have a disproportional impact on state and local governments? Does it depress wages? So let's kind of unpack those. Or, you know, what are the challenges of increased immigration?
Yeah. So let's first talk about the impact on native-born workers. I think this comes up a lot. You hear, you know, immigrants are taking jobs from U.S. workers. And I think most of the economic literature shows that's not generally the case. In particular, right now, if we look at just where the country is right now, we have had record low unemployment in this country. And, you know, last BLS data said we had about 1.4 job openings per unemployed worker in the United States. So there's plenty of work out there for U.S. workers and those who might be coming in. It's also true that to understand that we don't have a fixed number of jobs in the economy, that immigrants come in and yes, they might be working, but they're also demanding goods and services, which creates jobs for other people, right? So we talked about overall grows the economy. You know, we've done some research at the Bipartisan Policy Center where we looked at counties and their level of the foreign born in those counties. And what we found is that counties that had a higher percentage or number of foreign born did not show lower rates of native born employment. You know, in the research world, there's not necessarily that one-to-one, you know, if an immigrant is here working, then there must be an American who's out of work somewhere. It doesn't really work that way. A lot of the literature also looks at how immigrants fill in niches in the workforce that maybe fewer Americans are in. I like to say there is no job in the United States that has zero U.S. workers in it, but there are jobs that more immigrants are in or more Americans are in. And what we seem to find is that immigrants tend to be concentrated in lower end occupations that maybe are lower wage or require lower education or skills, and the high end that require high skills and levels of education. And most of the U.S. workforce is somewhere in between. And so what the labor economists say is that immigrants tend to be complementary to most U.S. workers. Where there is competition, and again, this is borne out by many economic studies, it tends to be with those who are just the previous generation of immigrants. And that has a lot to do with language acquisition and integration into the American workforce and economy. As English language skills go up, people can move into higher level jobs. Most native born Americans obviously speak native English, and so they can take some of those jobs that newer immigrants aren't able to fill. You know, as far as wages, the literature is a little bit more mixed. It tends to boil down to what methodologies people use. But the predominance of the literature says that where there is a negative impact on wages, again, it's to those workers who are most like the newly arrived immigrants. And it tends to be short term. Over the long run, immigration has seen increased periods of wage growth for U.S. workers. So just talking about the last couple of years where we've seen this large number of influx of immigrants, wage growth at the bottom end of the wage scale has actually seen record growth in the last years since COVID. So you wouldn't necessarily expect those two things to go together. So I think we have fairly good economic data that says the impact on U.S. workers is limited. In the long run, it's not there. And wage impacts might be there, but again, in the short run, I think what that means is that as policymakers, we want to figure out how we craft our immigration system so we can get that larger economic benefit. And then what do we do to mitigate whatever harms there may be?
You know, in the short term, one of the things that that happens is that there's a greater impact on state and local governments, I think, than there is on the federal government. You know, how does that work?
Well, when immigrants arrive, particularly younger immigrants who may have children, the immediate expenditures from governmental entities are at the state and local level, primarily in the very expensive realms of education and healthcare. Those are very big state and local level expenditures, some of which is supplemented by federal government income. And so you do see that when immigrants arrive in a place, they're more likely to be demanding of those social services at the local level than any federal benefits. For example, immigrants are not legally eligible for most federal means-tested benefits, including Medicare, Medicaid, until they've had a green card for 5 years, much less any temporary or other status. So they're not really claiming federal benefits, but they might be claiming some local benefits. And so that does have an impact on local budgets. We were just talking at the break that many states and localities are facing very tight budgets right now because a lot of the extra money they received from the federal government during COVID has gone away. So they were facing a revenue cliff from that. At the same time, some localities have seen a large number of new arrivals of immigrants to their communities. And we think primarily of big cities like Chicago and New York and Denver, but it's happening in other places too, that may be demanding more of these services, at least in the short run. And so that's creating big budgetary imbalances at many state and local levels that they're now asking the federal government to help them equalize.
You know, I want to talk about some legislative attempts to correct all these things. Several years ago, about a decade ago, a little bit more than that, a bipartisan bill passed the Senate with 70 votes, something like that. It was big, and it actually had it was very comprehensive. It would bring in a lot more people into the country. It devoted a lot of money to border security. And the CBO said that over 10 years, it would actually save $175 billion, which was a mix of something like $470 billion in new revenue and balanced against $260 something in new expenditures. So it kind of is a window into the way in which immigration reform could help the budget. Now, $175 billion over 10 years with, you know, $20 trillion worth of projected deficits, that's not, you know, a real game changer. But it does show that the potential revenues, at least to the federal government, would probably outweigh the benefits. Then you would have the economic benefits of increased workforce growth. But more recently, there was a bill more focused on border security, but it failed. You follow the events on the Hill probably more closely than I do on these things. Do you think there's any sort of path forward for an immigration bill to at least partially address some of these problems that we've been talking about?
The bill that was considered this year in the Senate was part of a supplemental package that President Biden asked for money from Congress to address what he called national security and foreign policy issues. And the bulk of that budget request was for support for Ukraine, support for Israel, and support for the South China Sea and Taiwan. And then a portion of it was additional funding to manage the border. The Republicans in the House said, we're not going to vote for more border money unless we see these policy changes. So that started a process in the Senate, because that's where this was being considered first, of a bipartisan group to try to negotiate policy changes around the border. So it's the first time we really saw border changes negotiated in a bipartisan way with input from the White House and the Department of Homeland Security in a non-immigration context, because the rest of this bill had nothing to do with immigration. And they were able to come up with a bipartisan package that had a lot of support from Democrats, from the White House, from many Republicans. But there were still a lot of opposition, primarily in the House, that thought it didn't go far enough or they wanted to see harsher. But more specifically, it's an election year. And the Republican Party, and particularly Donald Trump, who is running for president again, has made a big point about tying what's happening at the border to President Biden. And there was a political determination that if they were to pass this bill and give President Biden tools to manage the border, that issue would not be one they could then run on this fall. It didn't end up passing. It failed in the Senate. You know, honestly, I can look at that and think, well, we at least now have bipartisan legislative text on border changes that could be brought back. There's a bipartisan group in the House that's trying for a slightly different version of what the Senate was looking at and seeing if they can move that along. The White House is still saying they want to see legislation done. So there's possibilities. There's always post-election lame duck. But here's what I will say. We're not going to solve any of these things. We're not going to get the economic benefits of immigration we could. We're not going to manage the border better. We're not going to deal with any of this unless Congress is willing to legislate. And Congress has punted this issue, has failed so many times to come to agreement. They really need to take the lead, because without doing anything, it's not going to get any better. And I would say this, no matter who's in the White House, because of the litigation, because of the need for resources to do whatever an administration wants to do, and frankly, because without a change in the law, the president is limited in some of the things it can do. So I think we really need to lean on Congress to be the main player here. They need to figure out how they can really address all of these issues.
That is a main theme that goes to the overall fiscal policy issue as well that we talk about a lot. But that's all the time we have for this week. And so I want to thank you, Teresa Cardinal Brown, for being on the show and talking about immigration reform. You're the senior advisor for immigration and border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. This is your host, Bob Bixby. I'll be back again next week with another edition of Facing the Future.